Welcome to the Background Briefing podcast and the second part of a special investigation into radicalisation and violent extremism. Last week we heard about the way some young Muslims in Australia are being radicalised through personal contact with people known as sweet talkers for Islamic State. So how do you turn people away from joining extremist groups like IS? The key is to use authentic voices. Today, Sarah Dingle reveals de-radicalisation programs being quietly run by Muslim community groups in Australia with no government support. And she tracks down a former violent extremist helping to turn young Muslim jihadists away from violence.
Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Sarah Dingle. Today, we'll go inside hatred and hear about planning a massacre.
So we're going to buy weapons, and one of the guys even had, like, rockets or something that he flogged off a naval base. We had mortars. We had a pretty good collection.
And my investigation gets personal. I'll interview a man who used to want to kill people like me.
Yeah, I just wanted to go out and really just get as many Asians or, like the Lebanese homeboys that we could get, really. There wasn't any number, I guess maybe until the ammunition ran out, I guess.
So you were basically planning a massacre?
Yeah. Yep.
We'll learn how this leader recruited followers to his cause and just how close they came to a killing spree. Counter-terrorism expert Dr. Anne Ali.
Matt sheds light on how it is that the leaders or the recruiters take advantage of vulnerability and how they manipulate that for their cause.
Now Matt is working with Muslims to de-radicalise young jihadis. It's just one of a number of de-radicalisation projects which Australian Muslims are already conducting quietly in the community, largely for free. We'll hear just how difficult and sensitive that work is and who can deliver it. It's not what you say, it's who says it that counts.
The counter-terrorism measures, whether it's online or TV advertisement or whatever it is, has to come from those who know jihad inside out, and they're the only ones that the youth will listen to.
But around the country, Muslims young and old feel like they're under attack and they're closing ranks. De-radicalisation in a climate of fear. That's part two of our special investigation. For weeks, I've tried to speak directly with Muslim families whose children have joined the war in Syria. In Perth, Muslim volunteer youth leaders Aisha, Alam and Elmi say even amongst Muslims, the silence is deafening.
People suffering from the trauma of having their child being in trouble with the authorities and becoming a community pariah and losing face in the community. And it's all this, correct me if I'm wrong, Alim and Elmi, but this all, the community's going to talk about us.
There's that element of shaming, and no one wants to be in that space, to be the hot topic as such in the community. Nobody wants to be labelled as being a failure.
Grieving Muslim families are retreating into isolation. While in Perth, I receive a call from researcher Geraldine Hewitt, who's in Sydney. She's just had a conversation so strange that I decide to interview her.
On the weekend, I had a friend contact me very distraught. She wanted to ask me to delete a couple of people off social media. And I had met these people once, maybe a year ago. A friend of a friend's brother had gone over to Syria to fight against IS, and he had been killed. This family wanted to remove every trace of themselves so that there was no media attention paid to this death and that their family wasn't somehow identified via this.
She was just someone you met at a party who you added as a friend on Facebook.
That's right. And then I also was asked to delete mutual friends of ours that I also met at this party, and it was like any possible threads and overlapping connections between this girl and her friends had to be removed completely. So mutual friends between this girl and I, we had to lose contact because of her brother's death.
There's a lot of anxiety in the community, a lot of concern that they are targeted, a lot of fear about the powers of the state, the powers of police, and what can and cannot do.
Dr. Yasir Morsi is an Adelaide-based academic. He studies issues facing Muslims living in the West. Recently, he facilitated a forum in Sydney on counter-terrorism laws called Know Your Rights. It was closed to the media.
The turnout was about, I think, off the top of my head, somewhere 50 to 60 people, something along those lines.
Were there people there who had had their homes raided?
Yes, there was. I heard floating around that four or five people had existing cases. There is a general atmosphere that the Muslim community is targeted, that it's highlighted, that it's convenient to talk about Islam and Muslims when the problem is far more complex. It's very hard to feel at home.
Feeling at home is difficult, even for those hailed in the media as pillars of their communities, so-called moderate Muslims. Youth leaders Aisha Novakovic and Abdullahi Alam say this term is offensive and dangerous.
Can I ask you guys, the term moderate Muslim, you've all just pulled a face.
Yes.
Look, I completely disagree. I mean, you know, the listeners can't see our facial reactions, and probably that's a good thing right now. I mean, it's as ridiculous as saying, are you a moderate Australian? Does anyone else get asked that question? What does that even mean?
Or a moderate woman. What does that even mean? Exactly. You know, the term moderate, what it does is it affirms the views of the extremists because they've now become the reference point. I'm only moderate compared to an extremist. Mm. So you're validating their views, in essence. And that's very dangerous.
When all Muslims are seen as the problem, Dr. Yasir Morsi says people start supporting groups and speakers who normally they would denounce. Hizb ut-Tahrir is one highly controversial group which aims through preaching to transform what it sees as corrupt society into an Islamic society under Sharia law. Its spokesman Wasim Durehi had a recent fiery exchange with Late Line host Emma Alberici on ABC TV.
Why will you not point blank condemn the actions of IS fighters?
Because the question itself is offensive.
Men who cut off the heads of innocent journalists and aid workers. Why will you not take the opportunity? You have a national platform here.
The group has been on the radar of Australian security agencies for years, but until now the Australian government has decided against banning it. Now Prime Minister Tony Abbott has introduced new laws to make it easier to ban organisations like Hizb ut-Tahrir. Dr. Yasir Morsi says the result has been massive support for Hizb ut-Tahrir from Australian Muslims.
Hizb ut-Tahrir has always belonged to a politically contested Muslim community space. They've got supporters, they've got opponents, they've got enemies. I have never seen a more unified front in support of Hizb ut-Tahrir than after Tony Abbott made an example of them. Never.
Do you support Hizb ut-Tahrir?
No, I don't. I'm actually a critic, but I wouldn't air that criticism at this time.
Muslims in Australia are frightened, angry, and most worryingly, closing ranks. Last month, the Prime Minister's National Security Address confirmed people's fears, and it's likely to have set back counter-terrorism efforts within the community.
Now, I've often heard Western leaders describe Islam as a religion of peace. I wish more Muslim leaders would say that more often and mean it.
When he says that, the impact that it has on us is it's just devastating. It sets me back at least a decade.
Leading Muslim counter-terrorism expert Dr. Anne Ali was dismayed.
When you listen to our Prime Minister speak, and when you listen to the kinds of things that he is saying in his speeches and the way that everything is framed as national security, I don't think in either of those two speeches he once mentioned countering violent extremism. And then when you hear him say Muslims need to do more and they need to mean it, you've really got to wonder and think just where the government's commitment in this area lies.
3 days after the Prime Minister's speech, Dr. Ali received a package at work with no return address.
The package was wrapped in Christmas paper, and on the front of it was written terrorist and my name. So that was taken away by security, and I was later told that it was nothing serious.
The timing was particularly ironic. Dr. Ali had just returned from an international summit at the White House on countering violent extremism. In Washington, Dr. Ali says, the key message was the importance of community.
When I was at the White House and hearing President Obama speak and hearing him talk about the importance of civil society, the importance of enhancing the capacity of people, and listening to civil society from just about every other nation on earth had sent somebody over. And then there I was from Australia, the only civil society representative from Australia, currently not funded by government to do anything.
So what are we spending money on? And is that spend going to keep us safe? Dr. Anthony Bergen is the Deputy Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
Unfortunately, in this country, we do not really have an infrastructure around countering violent extremism. There's no dedicated published strategy around how the government intends to build a network of organisations, individuals and so forth.
Unlike counter-terrorism, which is policing and surveillance, countering violent extremism is predominantly the work of civil society to prevent terrorism or extremism of any kind which leads to violence. When the Australian government pledged an additional $630 million last August to boost national security agencies, it also announced a package for countering violent extremism. A pot of just $1 million was available to all community groups around the country to fund intervention programs for violent extremism. Applications closed this month, and the Attorney-General's department says there will be no further funding rounds. Anthony Bergen.
$1 million is a drop in the ocean, a tiny amount, given that we're investing, what, $630 million over the next 4 years in counter-terrorism.
The Prime Minister has also announced he'll appoint a National Counter-Terrorism Coordinator, already dubbed the Counter-Terror Czar. Dr. Bergen says the government needs to create an equally high-level position of National Community Liaison.
I think many of these conversations with relevant organisations are much better conducted behind the scenes and conducted quietly. So I'd like to see the Prime Minister appoint someone with that formal responsibility to liaise and report back to him and the attorney on the feedback from the relevant communities.
The Attorney General George Brandis declined Background Briefing's request for an interview. Around Australia, there are Muslim communities already on the front foot against radicalisation. A number of programs focusing on prevention and also de-radicalisation have been running quietly for years. These projects are being run largely for free.
The main facilitator for Al-Qaeda and Tahouli.
Volunteer community worker Khaled Almedian has invited me to his home in Sydney.
There are plenty of people. They're eager to go and involve in fighting. And we prevented them. And we convinced them. We convince. We don't force the people.
Khaled Almedian says when running an intervention, authenticity is the key. He's of Syrian background.
It's very convincing when I'm saying, OK, I'm Syrian. I am from Syria. I've just came to Australia 5 years ago and I went to Turkey twice. So I know the situation, the ground. I met many jihadists, local and foreign jihadists. I know what's going on in the ground. It's not paradise there. It's very hard life there. It's make you confused about your belief. And at this stage, you'll be trapped.
Khaled says the current climate of fear and silence makes running interventions harder, but he can still make the connections which law enforcement can't, once again, because of who he is.
Our community is well connected. We go to the mosques, we know a lot of people inside our community, and they trust us. Like, we have considerable number of people who trust us.
How difficult is it to tell if someone is being radicalised?
It's like signs of disease with someone, from his attitude, the way he speaks, sometimes the way he thinks, and his opinion about the situation in Australia and outside. We have at least doubled or tripled of the people to behave in this way, to be isolated. Now we have a growing number of women, and they are eager to go overseas, by the way. And many of them tried, but they couldn't.
Were they stopped by customs or by their families?
Now by their families. To deal with the women, it's very complicated, and it needs like support from that female side. This is like make our work very hard. The men, it's easier than them.
So girls are more secretive than boys?
Exactly, more secretive, yeah.
To run these interventions, Khaled Almedian has built a team of people, almost all of whom are volunteers.
We have at least 15 people work with us. Most of them, they are professionals, specialists and psychologists, like community workers, social workers, teachers, engineers, doctors.
So do you have any sources of funding for the work that you do?
So far, no, we don't.
Khaled Almedian and his team try to satisfy the desire for action in would-be jihadis by pushing people instead into Australian-based humanitarian work.
What we are saying and what we are trying to tell them, it's the truth. We don't lie. It's about if you go and involve in fighting there, what you will achieve. You will die and you will lose your life for maybe nothing. You can have here in Australia a beautiful life and you can help. You'll be more productive here than you will go there.
This approach addresses a major factor in radicalisation which is often overlooked. Professor Michelle Grossman is a Victoria University researcher on countering violent extremism, who has worked with the Victorian police.
You hear the phrase death cult being applied to Islamic State, and the end result of what they're advocating absolutely results in terrible destruction and death. But I think the experience of young people who are getting involved and going down that road is in some ways that they've never felt more alive. And the reason that I say that is because the call to action is the key. Young people, certainly in the research that I've done, are not content to be witnesses to historical events as they unfold. They don't want to stand on the sidelines watching things happen. They want to do.
Dr. Grossman says the promise of action is one of the key draw cards of ISIS.
The ISIS narrative is also about building a new state. It's about building a new world. Now, what that really taps into is a range of idealistic impulses that we know young people are attracted to. Young people want to do big, important, good things. It makes me feel very, very sad that we are now living in a world where we don't seem to be able to effectively provide the kinds of alternatives that will help redirect and divert, in particular, young people, young men and young women, with what it means to lead a life in which harming other people is not the primary focus.
Khaled Almedian says his positive action-based approach is working, but he's unwilling to say exactly how successful it's been.
How many people have you stopped from joining the fighting?
There are plenty of people. Trust me, plenty of people. So I don't reveal the number because the people may know how many people I know. I'd want to protect them because they want their life to be normal.
Now, Khaled Almedian wants to take this one step further.
The people who want to go overseas, they want to do a good thing for some people in Syria. How can we change his attitude from doing violent action to non-violent and legal action with better result?
He's put in an application for federal funding to provide an alternative path for Muslims drawn to Syria, instead posting them in neighbouring countries like Turkey or Jordan to teach English to Syrian refugees. Khaled Almedian says this project will be carefully risk managed. Whether his funding application will be accepted remains to be seen. Measuring the success of prevention is always difficult because you're trying to measure something which never actually happens. But experts agree what matters most in reversing the process of violent extremism is not what you say, but who says it.
You know, you can put out as many messages as you can. Really, it's the authenticity of the message that's going to be whether or not it works. So really, authenticity is a key here.
Dr. Anne Ali is producing a series of online materials using the voices of former violent extremists and people who have gone to the war in Syria to warn others off violence. The project is currently unfunded. One of the people Dr. Ali has approached is Zaki Mallah, who returned to Australia in 2012 after spending weeks with the Free Syrian Army.
The counter-terrorism measures, whether it's online or TV advertisement or whatever it is, has to come from those who know jihad inside out, and they're the only ones that the youth will listen to.
So legitimacy matters.
That's right.
Zaki Mallah says there's a world of difference between a message coming from government and a message coming from someone like him.
I've been there, seen it all, and I've come back. These guys will be looked upon as, what do you know? You haven't been there. You haven't seen it all. Why are you trying to tell me not to go? For someone like me who's been there, done that, seen it all, and come back, I have that experience. I have that connection now. I have that understanding, the insight. So maybe it could be that one or two may listen to me.
Last week, Zaki Mallah told Background Briefing that he personally would go back to Syria in support of another jihadi group involved in the civil war, the Islamic Front. The Islamic Front is not currently listed as a terrorist organisation in Australia. But Zaki said that even if it was, that wouldn't affect his decision to go. I ask Anne Ali about the dangers of using the voices of those close to this conflict.
Look, I don't think that all formers are necessarily role models. But I think the value of using former voices is the authenticity of those voices. The reality of someone like Zaki can sit up and say, look, I went over there, I went to Syria and I saw, and now this is my life now. This is what I'm dealing with now.
Zaki Mallah told us last week that it's now impossible for him to find full-time work. I ask him how his parents feel about his activities in Syria.
Well, if they knew about it, my father would rip his shirt and my mother would pull her hair. But unfortunately, they've both deceased. So I lost both my parents when I was young, at the age of 13 and 14. But if they were around today, they'll be like any other parent that has had lost their son with ISIS, who have travelled to Syria and have joined ISIS. You know, they go crazy, they'll go berserk.
What happened to your parents?
I lost my parents at a young age, and so the state got involved and took me in.
When it comes to de-radicalisation, family can be highly influential. In Germany, an innovative program based on family counselling aims to help parents stop their children being groomed and isolated by violent extremists. The program is called Hayat, which means life. It was developed by Daniel Kohler, the director of the German Institute on Radicalisation and De-Radicalisation Studies, who joined me on Skype.
What I want to do with the Hayat methodology is to help the family and friends of potentially radicalizing individuals become something I call a living counter-narrative, someone who can oppose and counteract the radical ideology, the radical group that's pulling the person out of the family into potentially active combat in Syria or Iraq.
Daniel Kohler says extremist recruiters will deliberately try to cut the ties between the person they're grooming and that person's family. He trains other family members not to rise to the bait.
It's complex because they use a lot of traps, they use a lot of provocation. There are people on the other side who are trained in recruitment, who are trained in human resources or headhunting. They know exactly what they're doing. So this is why there needs to be an intense counseling, expert counseling for these families, how to do it exactly. So something I would always stress as one of the most important things is always try to keep the contact open, try to keep the communication open. If that breaks up, the chance of reaching the person again in the future or having any influence is almost zero.
The UK and Canada are already implementing the Hayat program, and in Germany, Daniel Kohler's institute is overwhelmed with need.
Since they started in 2012, they have received more than 1,600 calls, resulting in almost 600 counselling cases. And this is a massive success. And these 600 cases, about half of them, are in the mid to high level radicalisation.
In Australia, counter-terrorism expert Dr. Anne Ali has been trying to introduce the Hayat family counselling model, but so far government has refused to fund it. So Dr. Ali is concentrating on her online project with former extremists, using authentic voices. She says this is not just about Islamic State.
The process of becoming an extremist and then adopting violence, there are a lot of similarities between different ideologies and the causes. So we're not about challenging the ideology of Islamic State, but we are about challenging the violence of any form of extremism.
To Dr. Ali, what matters is stopping the violence, because all hate is the same.
Hi.
Hello.
Sarah Dingle from the ABC.
You're welcome.
Nice to meet you.
In Sydney, I've come to the house of a man called Matt. I'm nervous. Matt is white and I'm Asian. Matt used to want to kill people like me.
Well, we're planning to just go into the cities and that and just wipe out as many Asians and Arabs and that as we could.
This is the first time Matt has told his story publicly. He grew up fighting.
I grew up in Western Sydney, so Blacktown. It was all mainly like just white Australians. Everyone was pretty poor. Your mother taught scripture, and my dad was just hardworking, you know, bread on the table sort of work. But they were never really home, because they were both working like really late. I'd always be out in the street, you know, getting up to trouble or whatever.
At what age did the fighting start? Did that start when you were still in primary school?
Yeah, it started in year five. So the whole school just went for me. You know, sometimes there'd be like 10 or 15 blokes on me, so yeah, I just had to pull the crowbar out.
At what age did you start taking a crowbar to school?
I think I was about maybe year eight. Yeah.
So 13, 14?
Yeah.
At the same time, Matt was learning to hate all Asians.
For me anyway, like, I was against Asians because you know, all my whole family had been over, like, either Vietnam or, you know, World War II fighting with the Japanese. Yeah, you know, just hearing all the stories of guess what my grandfather went through in prison or war camps and stuff like that. It's probably don't really need to know when you're a young fella. I think also, like, at the time, like, that was sort of when we started noticing, like, a bit more of the Asian community starting to mix with ours, and yeah, it's just that whole hatred started, you know.
In year nine, Matt found a solution to both being beaten up and what he saw as an Asian invasion. The solution was more violence.
I was just so angry, like, had so much anger from, you know, beating up my whole life up until then. I just sort of, like, cracked, and then anyone that looked at me, I just went and took on. But then, like, I found that I got respect from that. So then guys actually started to keep away from me. And then more guys joined my group because they kind of wanted to hang out with someone that was so highly respected, I guess, by fear. And, yeah, so then I started my group, yeah.
To keep his group together, Matt did what many violent leaders have done before him. He developed an ideology which was hating Asians.
The whole idea of, like, let's get all the Asians. You know, I didn't say it to them, but let's get out my anger, really, out on the Asians. You know, maybe I'll use all these other blokes for the same cause, but they didn't know that.
Matt formed a violent gang who went around the streets of Western Sydney bashing Asians. Matt made sure his followers carried weapons, including sledgehammers.
Oh, we just carried, like, yeah, like bars and, you know, like sledgehammers and stuff like that. Some things that were going to give that feeling of force, I guess.
He says the sledgehammers were just for show, but not the bars.
We'd pull out a pole or something like that. People were freaking scared when it's something more than a fist. But I remember at the time, like, guys had swords and, you know, everyone pretty much carried a knife.
Matt kept a tight grip on the leadership, making sure he was unchallenged and not putting himself at risk.
The leader's always the one hiding, and probably the most dangerous, because the leader can always go off again, get another bunch of followers.
What you're describing is basically a cell, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's like a survival cell that turns violent.
As the leader of his cell, Matt was good at spotting potential recruits to his cause.
I had other guys that meet at parties and talk about it. You could pick the people because you'd been through it. You knew which bloke was having troubles or whatever, and you could just go over there and go, hey, man, what's going on, you know?
How did you know you could trust those guys? What did you do to check them out or to bind them to you?
Well, you know, back then everyone was into smoking pot and stuff like that, and I actually didn't touch it. You know, when I started to get all happy and everything like that, and then I could jump in and, you know, start talking about how we look after each other and, you know, we're so much closer and just putting all that family, you know, loyalty and respect and all that into them, you know. And I would always do that. Like, if one of those guys got picked on, I'd be there straight away.
You create an alternative family, basically, for yeah. these guys.
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
And you picked guys who were already a bit disenchanted or removed from their families.
Yeah. Yep. Like, blokes and their families went around, or it was, like, a divorce problem, or they got a stepdad that doesn't care about them, or drugs, alcohol problems, gambling problems.
Was it like a brotherhood?
Well, yeah. Yeah, because you need them to, like, come to you for everything. I mean, you need them to, like, believe that you know that they're going to back you no matter what.
Matt led two groups. One was a core group of five who were the most trusted and the most violent.
There was about four of us in the core group. And the other group had probably round up about 100 blokes, 150 blokes.
The much larger group was for starting big street fights to distract the police, while the smaller group did the damage.
Yeah, they were really, really angry. So I knew that those guys were going to do some damage.
Did the police ever pick any of you up? Did they ever twig to what you were doing?
No, police had no idea. Nothing at all. And really, they should have. Some soldiers were, were throwing Molotov cocktails at people's houses and stuff like that. I remember a couple of times we were firing off rockets.
After 2 or 3 years of street violence, Matt started planning bigger operations. The core group began to work on his master plan.
Well, we're planning to just go into the cities and that and just wipe out as many Asians and Arabs and that as we could. So we're going to buy weapons and plenty of rounds. We worked out where we could bury them in Kashmir. And, you know, so if the police ever came over and one of the guys even had, like, rockets or something that he flogged off a naval base. Yeah, we had mortars. We had a pretty good collection.
What was the game plan for the day?
Yeah, I just wanted to go out and really just get as many Asians or, you know, like the Lebanese homeboys that we could get, really. Yeah, so there wasn't any number. It was just, I guess, maybe until the ammunition ran out, I guess.
Just kill as many people as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty sad to say, but yeah.
So you were basically planning a massacre?
Yeah. Yep.
Had you thought much about killing people?
No, not at all. It's only now that I realised that I would have been killing people. Like, back then I was just filled with anger and I just wanted to take that anger out.
Before Matt could lead his followers into a massacre, events overtook them. In Port Arthur, Tasmania, Martin Bryant went on a shooting spree. After that, all law enforcement agencies were on high alert and the group had to lie low.
Like, the Martin Bryant event happened and that was it. The guns were off the streets and made it a bit harder for us, yeah.
How close were you to carrying out this attack when the Port Arthur massacre happened?
I'd probably go to, like, 3 to 6 months.
In that pause, something happened to Matt that made him start to question his own ideology.
I was just waiting for the bus to go home one day. A bunch of guys came in and were pretty sure I was asleep. And they just bashed my head into the wall for no reason. So I woke up. Those guys were like, give us your money and everything. And I was like, man, why don't you know who I am? They just kept going for it.
Then a man in his 40s came along. He was Asian and waded straight in to help Matt.
And he just came back and kept checking to make, like, you know, he'd be like 2 or 3 and then come back, like, why have you ever broken? And he'd be like, you're right, mate, you okay? Is everything all right? You know, and then he'd go back and fight a little bit more and come back and check me again. And he took off. And then after that, I was just like, oh, hold on a sec. You know, we're going around beating up all these Asians and we want to kill them all, but this guy just saved my life pretty much.
Matt started to question what he was doing. First, he avoided his own followers, and then he realised he had to de-escalate them and undo what he'd done.
Yeah, I couldn't tell everybody at once because, you know, there's always another guy that wants to take over and earn all that respect, and you just had to, like, choose, you know, the guys that would be a bit more easier to let go and then the other ones that were a bit tougher, so I just started working on the ones that were a bit tougher first.
Did it take a while? I imagine you can't undo something in a single conversation.
Yeah, it probably took about a year. You know, I was helping them out with like pushing areas where they can work and even like finding sourcing work for them and stuff like that, because I knew I just need to get these guys doing something else and get them distracted.
So basically for about a year you were running a one-man de-radicalisation program where you were trying to find these guys work and talk them out of violent ideology.
Yeah. I didn't really see it like that, but yeah.
It was difficult for Matt to let go of his own violent extremism. He may not have hated Asians as much as before, but he still had hate. How many years did it take to get over the hate?
Maybe another 10 years. I mean, realistically, I could say that, you know, I never really got over the hate. Like, I could say, you know, I've only recently got over the hate recently, I could say. You know, it's always been there.
You say you only just recently got over the hate. Is it odd for you being interviewed about how you hated Asians by an Asian?
Nah, not at all.
I find it odd, as the Asian.
Yeah, it's actually one thing that I'd love to change in Australia is, you know, that you're not actually Asian because you're Australian. You know, and like you got a coin, both sides of the coin. You know, one's racism, one's extremism. You know, the racism leads to extremism.
Now Matt is once again trying to talk people out of violent extremism, focusing on Muslim would-be jihadis.
I'm a different person now, so I'm not the person that I was back then when I had all that hatred. You know, I lived my life and I got the support that I needed. Yeah, some of the other blokes have as well. Yeah, so we're different people now. We're actually here trying to help, you know, prevent this from happening in the future.
Matt is one of five former violent extremists volunteering with Dr. Anne Ali's program.
Matt sheds light on how it is that the leaders or the recruiters take advantage of vulnerability and how they manipulate that for their cause. And oftentimes it's a very egotistical form of manipulation. It's like, okay, well, I know where I am. I know not to cross that line, but I can use my power to manipulate that young person who doesn't have a father. I can be a father figure or a big brother figure to that person and manipulate that person to cross that line.
Matt is upfront about manipulation. You are the leader of your group. Tell me about being a leader. Why do leaders need followers?
Leaders, well, they need followers because ultimately, I guess they're too gutless to go and sort it out themselves, or they're too scared themselves. So if they get followers, you know, then they can use those guys to go and do what they need to get done without doing it themselves.
Dr. Ali says, as well as using Matt, she'd like to use the knowledge of former jihadis from the war in Syria.
The legal situation at the moment, the legal framework at the moment, is that it's very, very difficult to access anybody who has returned because they immediately become part of the legal system. They will either be in jail or they will face some form of legal action that will mean they're very protected from any kind of intervention.
Is that a wasted resource?
I think it is. I think what we need to understand is that looking at the research about returnees, there is not just one kind of returnee. Some of them have returned completely disillusioned. They're a huge source of authenticity and authority and an authentic voice about what it's actually like over there that can be used to prevent other people from going over there.
The need for prevention and de-radicalisation is huge. In Perth, volunteer youth workers Aisha, Alam and Elmi are already running interventions and dealing with young people who have lost friends and family to Islamic State. Alam and Aisha say they're desperate.
We're at a boiling point almost. I mean, you have the imminent issue of foreign fighters, you have the concern of a political establishment that just isn't doing as much as they probably should. There are just so many issues there, and I think we're at a point right now where we're trying everything. We're trying anything that we can to make contributions to our community.
We're like that duck, you know, trying to be calm on the outside, but paddling like crazy underneath, and we don't sleep at night, and we're trying to make all the connections that we can, and we need to go with that.
for Somali youth leader Elmi, it comes back to the importance of strong family connections.
I had so many young people saying to me, would you be my dad? If you see exactly what he's trying to say is, nobody's listening to me, you do listen to me. The more you talk to them, the more you find out there's no father figure in their family at all.
There are many parallels between the situation facing young Muslims now in Australia and how it was for Matt when he was growing up.
Do you reckon there's more kids like the kid you were right now in Western Sydney?
I think there'd be a lot of kids like I was then, not just in Sydney, like all over Australia. You know, think about all the kids, especially like these Muslim kids, you know, the kids are growing up with the hatred that everyone's put on the community. And the kids are the ones that are going to build up with the anger, and they're going to need to get rid of that. And if they don't have the support for it, you know, if you push someone in a corner far enough, they need to get out.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research, Anna Whitfeld. Additional research by Geraldine Hewitt. Technical production by Simon Branthwaite. The executive producer is Chris Bullock. And I'm Sarah Dingle.